This time 40 years ago, the Falkland Islands were in the final days of an occupation by Argentina. Tim Miller was living on a small settlement called Dunner's Head over on West Falklands. Making that all-important morning cuppa, Tim was waiting for the kettle to boil when some unexpected British visitors popped by. But they were not after a brew.
I suddenly heard the roar of jets, so I just rushed outside to see, well, whose is it this time, ours or theirs? Our bungalow was just off the end, less than 100 metres away from the end of the main grass airstrip, to be confronted by two RAF ground attack Harriers, very, very low at about 50-odd feet or so, coming straight towards me.
Oh, my life.
And the Harrier, with its wings that are drooped slightly, angled slightly down, when they're coming at you head on like that fast, by God, they're an evil-looking aircraft. Mm. And each one had three black blobs hanging underneath it. And said black blobs suddenly dropped off. And then everything went up in explosions and flames.
The RAF had seen the airstrip and, to stop the Argentines using it, had bombed it. Unfortunately, they hadn't realised that there were families living nearby.
Luckily, in direct line between me and where the bomb exploded, was our, what in those days we used to call our meat safe shed, which is a very solid little timber garden shed built of hardwood timber, 1 inch thick. That apparently was sufficient to deflect enough of the explosion to stop my lungs collapsing and so on with the, right, with everything else. And also it absorbed a heck of a lot of the shrapnel. But not quite all of it. So I found up in a faint. I was sort of, you know, one eye was sore and I couldn't see out of it, and blood was sort of pouring out of it. And I had some blood around my wrist, and also up on the top of my head where another little piece of shrapnel had gone in.
With a serious injury, Tim knew that he had to radio the doctor in Stanley. But his eye wasn't the only thing damaged by the bomb. The radio had been fried, so someone had to go up the telegraph pole to fix it.
I was the only one that had a head for heights. So Muggins here, with one eye bandaged up, and you know, I was the guy who had to go up the ladder and get the damage repaired. While I was doing that, the bomb has got a direct hit on the little farm store there, where, of course, we keep, amongst in the store there, there were some shotgun ammunition and some .22 rifle ammunition. And the .22 ammunition all started to cook off in the fire. And so all of a sudden there was ping, 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 where so my two brave mates at the bottom of the ladder rapidly disappeared. They did say afterwards it probably wasn't one of their finest moments. But
not wanting to face round two from the RAF Harriers, Tim and the rest of the settlement got on the move to Charters Farm, which was about 30 miles away. From there, Tim made it to his brother's at Hill Cove, where members of the SBS were able to help Tim in seeking out medical staff. Doctors on HMS Fearless at Ajax Bay and the SS Uganda all said the same. Sadly, Tim had lost the sight in his eye and there was nothing to be done. When liberation came, Tim was taken back to the settlement at Dunner's Head, where he heard the familiar sound of those British visitors.
A helicopter arrived and these RAF guys started to get out of it. As they came up to us, one of them said, "There's a chap here by the name of Tim Miller." And I said, "Yes, that's me," and sort of took a step forward. Whereupon Flight Lieutenant Mark Hare promptly took a step back. I cannot remember to this day what my first words were to him when he said, "It was my bombs that got you." But I distinctly remember, even 40 years on, he was carrying a good old standard RAF bluey-grey canvas holdall that was going clink, clunk, in a very nice, glassy, alcoholic-sounding manner.
The two men stayed lifelong friends. Mark Hare sadly passing away last year.
Journalists talk about this expression of friendly fire. Believe you me, it doesn't matter a damn whose drops on you. friendly or not, because it all goes bang exactly the same way.
This time, 40 years ago, the Falkland Islands were in the final days of an occupation by Argentina. What the Argentines didn't bank on, though, was a group of islanders who were giving critical help to British troops as they moved forward on enemy strongholds around Estancia and Mount Longdon. What the Argentines also didn't bank on was that one of these locals was Trudy McPhee.
The next morning, big Chinook landed out here, jumped out on the green, submachine gun pointed on the house, and these big fat officers come up, and there was a fence out there, and I said, oh, we can either come over the fence or through the gate. And he said, oh, I'd like to speak to the boss, please. Who's the boss? No, it was me. So they took everybody's names and said if we would help the British in any way, our families would suffer. And he said, we're going to search your house now. Well, hang on. Two things are going to happen first. You're going to leave your gun outside. You're going to take your boots off. So this young fellow took his boots off, left his gun outside, come and just walked around the house and ate again.
22 locals and their vehicles were gathered up, and together they transported troops, supplies and rations towards Mount Estancia as the British troops continued their assault on Argentine positions.
Every morning we used to take rations to A, B and C company. We used to take water and ammunition and drop them off at all the different locations. And then in the afternoon, there were six of us. We used to have to take the advance party as far as we could in the night, and we'd stop there and they would go off. And then that's the only time you really got to sleep. And then when they come back, you drive back. Now, you know, I sometimes think people must think, you know, you're just talking a lot of rubbish, because, you know, we drove all around those mountains. We had no headlights. We had no lights whatsoever. Just amazing, wasn't it?
And the officer second in command of Three Para at no time sugarcoated what could have potentially happened to Trudy and the others.
Roger got us all in. And he says, things are getting serious now, Trudy. Not allowed to take anyone else with you now. It's just got to be you. I want you to write a letter home, because if you don't come back, we can give it to your parents. Now, that was a bit hard. So I just sat down and thanked my parents for all they'd done for me. And I loved them very much. And I knew they were worrying, and I was sorry that I'd caused them this worry. But I just had to do it. And, you know, sealed it up and left it there.
And when Major Roger Patton, second in command of Three Para, needed someone to put themselves in harm's way, Trudy volunteered.
Roger came around and he said, Trudy, do you know who would be a good guy to walk in front of the convoy? Because there was 14 BVs, 6 tractors and 9 civilian Land Rovers. So it was quite a convoy. And I said, I'll do it. Okay, he said. And I said, the reason I'm going to do it is that I don't want to get bogged and hold the convoy up. So I was this side of the vehicle and a paramedic was that side. And he gave me a pair of white gloves, which I wore behind, I had to walk behind my back. And we carried on and they opened fire on us, and the drill was to get away from the vehicle. Then they said, well, you've got to carry on because we've got casualties now. And you could stand on landmines or booby traps. So that's not very friendly, is it? And these two guys come out of the dark and said, who goes there? I was very pleased to see they were paras, I can tell you. At 5 in the morning, we went back through to, you know, where the headquarters were, where Roger Patton was. He says, Trudy, what are you doing here? They'll probably shoot hell out of anything west of here. Oh, I said, thanks a bunch. So as we left, we're going back around these peat banks. They opened fire on us. And the guy driving said, do you want a fag? I said, just stick your fag. Let's get out of here first.
After the conflict, Trudy received a letter of commendation from Admiral Sir John Fieldhouse, commander of the British forces in 82. She also received a medal from the Paras. In the words of a great man called Gandhi, strength doesn't come from the physical capacity. It comes from an indomitable will.
It genuinely made me feel so angry, because I hate bullies. You know, I hate people bullying people. A lot of people said, oh, well, weren't you scared? I don't know why I wasn't scared. I just had this feeling of we're going to sort, and if I could help in any way.
This time, 40 years ago, the Falkland Islands were in the final days of an occupation by Argentina. Ailsa and Tony Heathman lived with their 10-month-old daughter at a settlement called Estancia, which is around 16 miles as the crow flies from the capital, Stanley. Their farm was visited by a number of Argentine soldiers, some of whom were clearly flummoxed by the terrain and the nearby mountains.
All the ones that turned up here were lost and hungry. We used to go and ask, get a map and try and find out where they'd come from or where they were going, but they had no idea. Sometimes I'd bring them into the house, put them on the telephone to David Barton at Deal Inlet, because he was a fluent Spanish speaker. Sometimes he couldn't understand the dialect either, and we still couldn't establish what they were doing or where they were meant to be. So we used to just try and get rid of them somewhere if we could. First one, Tony and Don Davidson, took him round to Long Island nearly, because we knew they were on Long Island Mountain at that stage. So they gave him a packet of biscuits and told him to get out and walk when they got close enough to see where he was going. And then we had another five. I've no idea where they turned up from, but they jumped up and pointed guns and shouted to Tony one really frosty morning in May, early May. And they demanded food and sent him in here for food and water and something to drink. But we persuaded them eventually to get in the transport box on the back of the tractor, and we took them to the camp on Mount Kent because they were up there by then. And then again, same thing, when they got close enough, they stopped. But they really thought they were trying to trick them into taking them to a British camp to start with, I think.
Right.
And once they got there and realised it was their own, they were trying to give them crucifixes and 10,000 pesos and God knows what then.
And some of the young soldiers were not overly experienced or kitted out in the craft of war.
They hadn't a clue. I mean, we had two more come down from the camp on Mount Kent one afternoon. I think they were hoping I'd feed them, but I didn't. Wearing plimsolls, one had a rusty FN, one had no gun at all. Don Davidson could speak a little bit of Spanish, so we asked him where his gun was. He said he'd forgotten it.
Soon enough, there were a lot more visitors to the farm. And I mean a lot. But they weren't Argentine.
Well, three pair turned up. And before that, we'd had the SAS. They came in on the night of the 29th of May and shot us up. Thought there'd been a couple helicopters in here that afternoon, and they thought they might be moving troops in. So that was our first British contacts. And then the next night, Terry Peck came in with D Company of three para and said the whole company or detachment would be here the next night at 10 o'clock. Nobody said Zulu time, of course. So they all turned up on the night of the 31st of May, and then they deployed the next couple of days, A, B and C Company, up over the Estancia Mountain, out as far as Mount Finette and various locations. But there was a lot of activity still here, of course. All the helicopters landed up there, just out from the shearing shed now, which wasn't there then. Teeny Weenies had a small base, the Army Air Corps guys, with their gazelles and skates there on the other side of the creek. There was a marine landing base down the tar barrel at the end of the creek from the house here. We had a lot of foggy weather initially, and they couldn't get a lot of supplies in, so they were bringing stuff down from Tinlilip by sea, because they had landing craft in there. A few marines came through here, most of them bypassed us. So they were up here behind us, between Mount Kent and Bluff Cove Peak, largely in that area. And the Blues and Royals were here with three para and also 9 Squadron. So it was quite a busy little place for a while.
With 66 foxholes at one time in the garden, Ailsa's front room was also utilised.
And then, of course, the front room in there was the three para hospital throughout the time they were here. A steady stream of bad feet through here for days on end. That was their biggest problem, really, was the feet.
Today, there's not much sign of the foxholes. The front room isn't used for treating trench foot, and the only soldiers popping by are those from Mount Pleasant or Three Para or other veterans. The house is full of memorabilia, remembering those that 40 years ago used that farm to do their bit to liberate the islands.
We've got quite an affinity with the Marines too, but they get quite annoyed when they come to my house because the paras keep coming back and giving me all this para stuff that's dotted here and there. They have the rivalry, but they're all one and the same to me. The best you can get.
This time, 40 years ago, the Falkland Islands were in the final days of an occupation by Argentina. Situated to the north of West Falkland and with an airstrip, Pebble Island was the perfect location for Argentine forces, being strategically close to the landing site at San Carlos. Pebble was quickly set up as a forward operating base with a number of aircraft, including the dangerous ground attack Pucaras. This meant that Ray Evans and the small amount of Pebble Islanders found themselves under occupation.
Oh, we had quite a few flybys with the Pekaras, but one day we got information that the Islander was coming because we just started getting them to bring us mail. Anyway, Dad and I went up to the airstrip, met the aircraft, and there was two Argentines, one flying and one in the front, and there was a couple of people going to Roy Cove. And we'd been doing work to the airstrip, laying drains. And one fella got out and went down and started jumping on them. And we never thought anything of it because, well, just getting ready for takeoff. So that went by. And then that afternoon, there was a helicopter arrived. Some soldiers jumped out and they were charging around all over the place. And but a couple of guys went to see Dad because Dad was manager there at the time and told him that we were going to be occupied. That was as much as he told us.
And of course, being under occupation means that those everyday tasks can get a lot harder and a lot more dangerous to do.
We quickly learnt that the earlier you started asking to get out, the better, because if you left it too late, they would shut down, or if something happened, they would usher you back into the house. Mm. And yeah, there was quite a few times like that. And then one night, they reckoned they could see lights in one of the windows, so they said, we'll take somebody out each night to go around all the windows. Well, that was quite scary because the first night that I went out, they said, stop when I say and make sure I'm right behind you, because there was others around with guns all over the place anyway. That was quite scary, that, actually. I didn't really like that. Mostly every night you would hear gunshots going off because something had spooked them or whatever, yeah.
Eventually, the Argentines, like they had done at Goose Green, forced the islanders to leave their homes and live in one place, a six-roomed house. Of course, British forces were never going to leave this strategic airfield intact for the Argentines. And on the 14th of May, Special Forces led a raid where the enemy's 11 aircraft were all destroyed along with an ammo and fuel dump.
Well, I think we were all in bed. Would have been. And next thing we heard fireworks going off or explosions, and of course everybody shot out of bed. And you had to be very careful when you went to the windows because otherwise they might see you. But anyway, we could see the sparks and stuff going on up on top of the hill where the aircraft was. And at that time, I think it was the ships actually shelling for the guys to retreat. Yeah, that went on for a couple of hours, I suppose. There was people running all over the place and that. We never actually seen any of the raiders, but there was some explosions up on the airstrip. And what they'd done, the Argentines, this was, I mean, they must have suspected that something could happen. They'd laid charges across the main runways, because we had the grass strip there for the islanders anyway. They'd flown Pekaras in and were using those.
The raid was considered a complete success with no British casualties, and Ray and the rest of the islanders scored a few home victories of their own.
Two strange things happened. The night of the raid, the mechanic that we had been doing something, and he used to run the generator, and it had a time switch on it for coming on and off, but because he was doing something out of the ordinary, he'd switched the switch off to manual, and the damn generator ran all night. Well, that got them jumpy, because they thought that we'd put it on purpose, you see, for the raid. Well, that was okay. And then the night of the surrender, I said to the guys that was there guarding, because I was assistant manager then, I said, do you want the generator left on for the lights down at the shearing shed, because they had them all down in there? Yeah, it might be a good idea. Norman forgot to put the switch on. So that caused a bit of a stir. Yeah.
This time, 40 years ago, the Falkland Islands were in the final days of an occupation by Argentina. Patrick Watts was the station manager at the Falkland Islands Broadcasting Service. And after reporting on the Argentine invasion of South Georgia and the developing political climate, Patrick was fast becoming aware of the gravity of the situation.
I was interviewing Rex Hunt, the governor, on a daily basis to get updates for my news programme about what was going on in South Georgia. So it was a great shock for me when I turned up at Government House about 4 o'clock on the afternoon of the 1st of April to see a whole set of gloomy-looking government officials, local government officials who I knew, walking out of Government House without even acknowledging me. And when I went in, Governor Hunt passed me this famous telegram, as it was in those days, from the Foreign Office saying, you know, we have every reason to believe that an Argentine force is on its way to the Falklands and they're likely to arrive by dawn. And the famous line at the end, make your dispositions accordingly.
The governor, Sir Rex Hunt, continued speaking to the Falkland Islanders through Patrick's programme, even when Government House was under attack, and the only way to get through was by telephone.
We lost contact with the governor. We had a fancy setup. We lost contact. So every transmission from him afterwards was done with me holding the telephone earpiece up to the microphone and opening up the fader. I was scared stiff. I mean, absolutely scared stiff. Until I opened the microphone up and started talking to people. And then I like to think, it might sound a bit ostentatious, but I think my professionalism as a radio broadcaster then came through, because all I wanted to do was produce a good program for the listeners, reciting information that the governor had already told us. And the people were amazing. They responded. I mean, you know, they put their lives at risk. They were ringing me up on the phone. And it was the old magneto telephone, so they had to go through the telephone exchange and then ask the telephone exchange operator to ring the radio station.
And the situation for the Falkland Islands just got worse.
He broadcast to the population that
it was a very grave situation. Around about 2 o'clock in the morning on the 2nd of April, he declared a state of emergency, and
I then realised that it was real, because I kept thinking all the time, the United Nations, Ronald Reagan, the United States President, will put pressure on Argentina to actually stop and turn around, but it didn't happen. I had two young children, aged 10 and 11, two daughters, very worried for them and my widowed mother. But I had to stay on my post. The governor basically ordered me to do so, and I had no choice. I never put up my hand and said, I want to be the man to be on the radio tonight. I just did what he told me to do.
At around 9 o'clock in the morning, when Patrick had been broadcasting all night, the Argentines arrived at the station.
I could hear them before I could see them. They were noisy. They were very exuberant, excited. They really felt that they had achieved something. I felt I got nothing to lose here, and I was very angry and upset about the fact that my islands had been invaded. So I just said to them, hey, look, you're in a radio station. First thing, no smoking in my radio station. I don't smoke, none of my staff smoke. If you're gonna smoke, outside. To my surprise, the officer in charge told them to stop smoking. And I said, quieten down, you're in a radio station now, not in a playground. You know, you've got to be quiet in here. And I will not be broadcasting with your guns here. You've got to take those guns out of this studio here and put them outside. I heard them clattering out, and they put them in the passageway, and then they came inside. I thought, well, that's all right. That's round one to me anyway, but I'm going to lose this on points for sure.
The radio station was used by both sides in establishing a ceasefire.
Because I was getting the messages coming in from the Argentines, I was then conveying these messages to the governor, saying, send out a man with a white flag, and we'll send out a man with a white flag, and we'll meet together in the main street so that we can negotiate. So I think, you know, that was important, that I was able to pass these messages on, because all I was trying to do was prevent bloodshed.
For the following 10 weeks, Patrick worked in the radio station, sharing airtime with the Argentines and doing what community broadcasters do best, providing that all-important link of information, reassurance and a friendly voice to their locals.
But when I look back now, I think, wasn't I fortunate to be the man there that night doing this job? Mm. Not because people want to talk to me, but simply because, you know, it's an experience in your life, in your broadcasting career.
BFBS, the Forces Station.